It is straight up at 8 o'clock. A very good morning to you. Welcome to the program. It's the Mornings with Ed show. And Dr. Anita Wong, a local MD in preventative medicine here in town, has been doing amazing work. And she started doing it because her many patients that she had cared for in the emergency department had requested such. She spent over 30 years as an ER doctor, previously at UCLA Medical Center, Eisenhower Medical Center, and St. Mary's Medical Center. Dr. Wong has a litany, a long list of accomplishments. She was also the team lead in the Beijing 2003 SARS outbreak, so she knows a lot about what we're about to cover this morning. We welcome to the program Dr. Anita Wong. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me. It's truly an honor.
Well, let me tell you that if ever we needed to talk to an expert, it is today. It is this very moment in time. And if I may just get right into it, you do amazing work here in town with wellness. A lot of COVID-19 patients who recover continue to struggle with symptoms after recovery. It's kind of a two-part question, I guess. What's the importance of a resilient immune system in recovery? And are we as Americans short-circuiting ourselves with our big gulps and fast food society that we live in?
So there's two parts in there. So as this nation, I think under the national data, they have listed 12% of us as healthy. The wow. appalling wow. small percentage. And it's really called the hidden hunger in this country, because we have, we have abundance here. We had, since 1950, the Jean Meyer. She's was the president of Tufts in 1960. She really tried to eliminate this malnutrition with empty calories, then that was 50 years ago. And they had 1,600 elements that they wanted to introduce into United States to be able to afford that everyone gets food, right?
Right.
Now, unfortunately, what has happened now, those measures have been put in place, and we have, lunch meals provided for children, et cetera, and we've done a great job, but we have gotten what is less nutritious food. So our food may not be nutrient dense or nutrient rich. And also people are eating things that are empty calories. So they are not nutrient rich. So we have obesity, but yet we have very obese, very large people who are malnourished. So you would think that someone who is overweight would not be malnourished.
Right.
But unfortunately, they are malnourished. When you are malnourished in this country, you don't have a disease. For example, that if you don't have enough vitamin C, you end up having scurvy.
Right.
Or you don't have enough vitamin D, you get rickets. Well, we're not talking at that level. It's a clinical deficiency where your cells are not getting what they need and nutrients. So to work efficiently and effectively and to have a strong immune system, and you want to be resilient. So our bodies are constantly battling infections and viruses all the time. It's not like that we're not seeing something and we develop antigens against these, and they recognize these as friend or foe. And the way they do these is that there are 8 to 10 nutrients that are really most important for infections, and they do it by 3 different mechanisms. And one of those ways is by direct effect against the protein. So we talked about before how SARS, COVID, the SARS-CoV-2
right.
enters the body, and is through the ACE2 receptor, which is the repair site. And if you ever heard me talk about it, I talk about the highway and the Caltrans on the highway, and that's the repair site,
right?
And which is a normal, healthy process. And then I talk about how the little white, the white trucks they call in, and the pavers come in, but they're kind of warped. If they're warped and they're not paving right, you're not going to repair that site. They can't finish that site, right?
Right.
So that's the nutrient deficient product. They got some food, they can't call it in, and they go, oh my gosh, there's no zinc in there.
Right.
When there's no zinc in there, then it can't actually bind to the protein in that site. So they can't really smooth that area out. And zinc, and once that paver comes in with the nice zinc, with the paver's nice, it seals it off and moves it off, and it's done. The zinc inhibits the virus from being able to use your protein at that site to replicate. Okay. If you don't have enough zinc, the virus can get in. Now, okay. Also, if you eat a lot of quercetin, and quercetin is in broccoli and is in onion, and that also blocks the protein and the ACE2 receptor sites. So that's only one mechanism. The other mechanism is that these 8 to 10 nutrients, like some zinc and vitamin Bs and things like that, they actually help to improve your ability to kill off pathogens.
Okay.
So the immune function works more efficiently. And then the third effect is it dampens these inflammatory responses. So that repair site, because when the repairmen are working, they're blowing off steam and smoke and all that. Well, that's normal inflammation. But when you have your enough nutrients, it dampens that down. And we know that with this SARS-2, that it actually can cause this pro-cytokine storm, increase that inflammation process that goes on.
And inflammation.
So those are the three mechanisms.
And inflammation is as big a killer, as big an obstacle as we have here, right?
That's what I believe, and this is where you'll see the difference between conventional medicine and functional medicine.
Right.
And I'm not bashing one or the other. Because I practice both, and I think that you need them in conjunction. I'm just going to kind of diverse here before answering that question. Is because in health, I think that many people are seeking the answer, right? And I always like to compare it to traveling, which we can't do right now. I so it's probably a bad example that people are going to want to go. But if you look at the traveling and you decide where you're going to go, some people say, I'm just going to go down to the next city.
Right.
Some people are going to go, I'm going to go around the world. Some people say, now, how am I going to get there? And so then you're going to decide that I'm going to walk there. I'm going to take a plane. I'm going to take a bike. I'm going to swim there. I'm going to, take a boat. Different methods. How long you're going to go, how far you're going to go. Those are the ways you can travel. Well, in medicine and health, there are many different practitioners and many philosophies of medicine. You've got your acupuncturist. You have your Chinese herbalist. You have your holistic naturopath. You have your functional medicine, you have your conventional medicine. I think every one of them is valid, but they have to go with the way that you want, how you want to attain your health. And conventional medicine has slowly to recognize inflammation, whereas functional medicine has recognized inflammation for over 30 years.
Okay.
So it is the process of, and we recognize that inflammation has been there. And you need a certain amount because that is a normal natural process. But when it becomes too much, it becomes deleterious to your body.
Right.
And so when you have someone who is obese because the fat cells, as I always used to go back to my Caltrans, when they're digging up and they're throwing out those extra large pieces, the jackhammering guy, right. And it's really those, I put those as fat globules, or I call them goodness, piles of goodness. That pile of goodness and then that little paver guy who's like not that's warped, and they go out into their fat cells or the goodness cells. They're not just sitting there. They're not just idle. They're in there churning inflammation constantly.
Right.
So that's where you're going to see that. So that's why COVID is more, you're seeing most of the people who have severe reactions to it with obesity because they have a lot of inflammation. And when you have too much inflammation, it's causing a lot of problems and causing the cytokine, especially in the lungs, causing the cytokine storm. So you kind of drown in your own mucus. There's just too much going on in there. So when on the recovery phase, and actually what I want people to have a lot of hope here is because we're all going out
right.
and getting back. And even though you will not lose weight, it'll take you years to lose weight. It takes you only a few months to change your metabolic cellular strength in there. So you can have immunity, resilience, and that's what we want. We want your immune system to be able to combat anything it encounters. And so that's why you hear all over the board, somebody had it, no, I just had a little runny nose. I didn't have much. I had a little bit of a diarrhea. I didn't have that much. And the others who are succumbing to it. So it depends on how resilient your immune system can fight this off. And you can change that by changing your diet. So if you're a big gulp drinker and just a lot of sugary drinks and eating a lot of pastries in the morning and, you know, pasta at night, and there's no colorful fruits and vegetables on your plate and not a lot of different vegetables. I just read that there's some, I don't know if it's true or not, there was somebody who lived to 145 or some, or 256 years, but they, a lot of them ate mostly herbs,
right,
and vegetables. And a lot of herbs really help us in combating immunity.
Now, before I ask you the next question, let me ask you about supplements. So let's say I'm looking to get more zinc. Should I take a supplement, or am I better off eating some a type of green food or something that would give me zinc in my food? How will it serve me best to take my zinc?
I have a simple one-liner I always tell people, because I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know the answer. But the short answer is you have to test, don't guess, right? Okay. So I don't know how well your diet is. I don't know how well your gut is absorbing. I don't know if your microbiome is working well. So just, we'd have to dive into everything. But it's just off the streets. So if I said, if you took nutrient-rich, so I don't know if the soil that you're growing, that's where they were growing the fruit, actually had selenium in it. And we're finding that people who had deficiencies of selenium succumb to this five times more. And people who have selenium at three times quicker out of the hospital than when they, of those who are hospitalized who didn't have it.
Right.
So it depends on where you're getting your food, how nutrient rich those foods are. But it's always, I think, best to get it from your foods if you know you have good quality food.
Okay.
If you have good quality food and you eat a diverse group of foods, you should be able to get it in your food. And what I say is, because there's question about the food source and how nutritious and nutrient rich it is in this country. So I have some concerns about that, and that's a whole nother topic. But so to be able to know, you need to test.
Right.
So, and you can easily test. That's one of my wellness things that I recommend to all my patients. Once a year, we check those levels. We check to see how well you're detoxifying, if you're absorbing. So my pescatarians, because they're more at risk of collecting mercury, we'll always try to stay on top of that. And, you know, your vegetarians, you know, your creatine is going to be down. So they're going to need to have supplements on that, because there's no plant source for that, and we need that amino acid, and they're not going to get that, so they have to have that supplement. And then there's genetic defects and mutations that you have, and when you know that if you have a poor methylation and you can't do that last detoxification pathway, which is a methylation,
right,
you're going to need a supplement for that, in that specific supplement. So there are certain ones, and once you've tested, you'll know certain ones which you have to take, and then certain ones that you know that if you've been eating poorly, you're going to say, you know, maybe I better start some of these, or I'm going to test and see what it is that I know, or I need to beef up my eating, or I'm going to take some supplements if I'm going to go off the wagon here and not eat so well. So that type of thing. So then you can actually judge and know, because there's so many supplements out there, so many herbs, so many things. But I think the best way is to ask specifically, know for your particular body what it is that you specifically need
to test. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Anita Wong. And Dr. Anita Wong is a wellness specialist who spent over 30 years as an ER doctor, previously at UCLA Medical Center and Eisenhower. She was also the team lead in Beijing for the 2003 SARS outbreak. And in preparing for this conversation, it's kind of like having a much smarter lab partner. I read that viruses can also infect a host with virulent DNA, which can affect normal cell process, and therefore it evades the immune system. Is that what you think that this virus is doing?
Well, I mean, yeah, so I don't know. I haven't really read up on that specifically. But definitely your our cellular DNA makeup and how well we combat things in terms of the replication. So it's I don't specifically know to that, but I do know that, that this virus is entering through the ACE2 receptor site.
Okay.
And that, you know, it's a RNA, where they're using our protein, which is a DNA, and then it's taking that protein, and because it's an RNA process, and taking it and turning it into their RNA protein process to build them. So I don't, I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, it does actually, and it leads to this question. So then at that point, it replicates and it eventually causes the cell to lyse? Am I using that term properly?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So it enters into the cell, and normally you have your T cells, your helper T cells, which then activates your immune system, and then it calls up and starts to call in your B cells, and then you want it to get into the cytokine reactive, and you want your killer T cells to be reactive. And so what happens is that they will actually destroy the virus, right? But then what this virus is doing instead, then it's going into there and it's being able to replicate. If you're not able, if your immune system and your protein that they used in there is not be able to identify and recognize this as a foe and that we need to engulf it and destroy it. Okay. So there is that balance in there. So you want to be so a healthy immune system identifies it, able to stop it from replicating, stopping it from using your DNA to replicate and destroy it. And what's happening is that we're having a weaker immune system because I believe because we're too inflamed and we're too micronutrient deficient.
Okay. Does that mean that it's possible that once we get it as a society, we keep it forever, like a shingles type of thing, that we wouldn't find a cure for it, that it would just continue like shingles?
So I don't know if it would be like shingles. Shingles is more of a herpes virus, so it's a little different in how it enters the body, but it would be like the other coronaviruses that we have. I mean, we have, there are 7 coronaviruses out there. 4 of them are the common cold.
Right.
2 of them, one was SARS, one was MERS. Now we have this one. So those are the 7. So with my, guess is that, and we've never found a vaccine for the 4 common cold.
Right.
We haven't found a vaccine for the HIV. That's a virus.
Right
now they have 90 virus vaccines out there they're trying to study.
Right.
90, and 2 of them was already went through phase 1. There's about 4 phases that you have to go through, and this has all been expedited. So I think the efficacy and the safety issues are of paramount at this point, because there's some of those vaccines that they're doing have not been vetted or licensed procedures by the FDA. So they're using unknown procedures to make these vaccines. But 2 of them was from SARS.
Okay.
So they started looking at these coronaviruses and started making the SARS virus vaccine. And they stopped making it, and they went through phase 1. Which means that they were able to develop immunogenicity in an animal. So they were able to infect an animal and were able to kill it in the animal with the vaccine. That's pretty much phase 1. And so because they were able to get out of phase 1, those 2 vaccines are now in phase 2, and so they're in clinical trials. So there are actually six vaccines in clinical trials with humans right now. So I don't know how they're going right now.
But in your best estimate, is 12 to 18 months, is that just wishful thinking? And is it positive? Is it possible that we don't discover a vaccine at all for this?
I think that is yes to both of those. It seems more hopeful because we're so far advanced with SARS, because it took them, SARS was what, 2002, 2003? Yes. It wasn't until 2007 that they got through phase one. So we've already gone through phase one, and now we're into this phase two. But I think that there's a lot of questions about how safe it is and how effective it's going to be. And if they can do it and they want to turn around that rapidly, I just don't know that we can actually do that. I think the better message to people is not to rely on, you know, medicines and vaccines and hospitals and doctors, but to rely on taking care of your body and being resilient, and let your body do what it can do naturally. And you need to fortify it. And that's easy. That's an easy fix. You know, eat colorful food. Eat some herbs. Eat vegetables. Eat fruits. Lower your sugar content. Don't eat so many empty wheat products, cakes and cookies and breads and pastas and pizzas and things. And I'm not saying that you don't eat those things, because certainly I still eat them, but I think that you have to be at modest, and you have to be able to know where your body is, and you can change that so rapidly, because when you look at conventional medicine, when they take a morbidly obese person and they do a gastric bypass, they don't lose that weight overnight, but in a few months, their diabetes goes away. Why is that? Because they can't eat as much of the bad stuff. They're starting to eat good stuff. They're monitoring their nutrition, and they're making sure what they get in there, because they can't eat as much. So they're being watched closely, and their diabetes goes away in a few months. Well, that's the same thing that we can do if we just change our habits here.
Okay. And speaking of easy fixes, there's so much talk about the easy fix of just taking hydroxychloroquine. And after a study, I read where a study of 96,000 patients that were followed, 9% of them died having not taken it, compared to the 25% that died taking it. What are your thoughts on on what the craze is for hydroxychloroquine?
The thing is that it is a pro-inflammation illness, right? So and those medicines are being taken with people who have autoimmune and who have pro-inflammation. So it really combats your immune system. And so we have pro-inflammatory states. We have under-reactive immune systems that are not working. And what you want, and what I mean by resilient, meaning that it can do its job properly. So you don't want it to be over-regulated, and you don't want it down-regulated. You want it to be modulated so that it can do the work properly. Right? So when it's over-regulated, you have to take these medications like this hydroxychloroquine and things like that when you have lupus and et cetera. And these people really need it to be able to function. And also I think that there's other things that they can do. But if we're just going to do it conventionally medicine, right, then they just take the medications, right, to decrease the inflammation. If you take a person who has an immune system, and let's say that it's just, we don't really know if it's not too resilient, and they're just a normal, healthy person, and they don't have a resilient immune system, and you give them this chloroquine, and they're not in a pro-inflammatory state. Right. So whether or not, the thing about the study, I think, was on the more critical people. And we have to be careful about how many studies, because a lot of these studies that are coming out, everyone's just throwing everything out, and they're not being as vetted as normally, because a lot of them wouldn't get passed through and get into the literature at this point.
Right. The one I quoted was New England Journal of Medicine.
Right. But the thing is that the inflammation state that it would work the best is at the beginning, when you're not as sick. Right. And I don't know if there's been a study that's proven that. It's not been proven. And so people are just taking it because they think that they can prevent this pro-inflammatory state. Right. And prevent it from getting into the cytokine storm at the end. Because if you take it at the end, it's not going to do anything. And so that's where that study is showing it. So there's nothing that proves that by taking it at the early on that it's going to reduce your pro-inflammation, because people are concerned, they're overweight, they have a more inflammatory state, so they think that if they take this, it's going to help modulate their immune system, but it doesn't. It doesn't modulate your immune system. It doesn't do anything for immune system.
Right.
It's just going to cut down the inflammation that you have, and then when you get the virus, you're just still going to have, if you lack zinc and you don't have the right nutrition, right, your body is still going to end up getting it in, and you're still not going to be able to, your immune system hasn't been upregulated to fight it off. So I don't think it's going to be just talking here, thinking it through. I don't think it's going to be helpful,
right,
because it's not helping your immune system to do anything. You're just, lowering the inflammatory sites of the, if you're overweight or if you had pro-inflammation, but it's really not going to help your immune system. But I don't just see it that beneficial.
Okay. I love that. Thank you for the very clear and coherent view there. It's we saw you do the math, and then we also saw you give us the work. I appreciate that. As I walk around and I walk into stores, and I find myself getting upset when I don't see someone wearing a mask. Are masks our future for the next year or so? Do you think that's the answer for right now?
Well, I think there's going to be a new normal, and I think that people need to understand that any time that there has been a major plague, a pandemic, the things that have extended life and have prolonged life, it's not been our modern medicine. Modern medicine has extended our life maybe 3 years. But back when our lives only were, we were lived to be 40, now we live to be, close to 80, it was sanitation, public health. So public health is what has prolonged our lives, where we had sanitation. We paved the streets. We made sewers. We made clean water, right? So it is public health. And what this pandemic has shown, which has been my pet peeve for many years, because every flu season is my pet peeve, we do not have a good respiratory etiquette in this country. And we have, and we are a very strong, dynamic, can-do country, and we will work until we drop dead, and we will share our germs with our coworkers.
Right.
During this pandemic, 35% of the people who were sick went to work. What about when we're not in a pandemic? I think a lot more people will go to work when they're sick. And I think that the thing that we need to change is our respiratory etiquette. That is the next public health thing that has to come about. And if that means face masks, then we need to do face masks. We need to be supportive. If you say, I've got a cold and I need to work remotely, I'm going to come to the meeting today through a remote, I think we can show that it can happen. So we need to be able to support the people who live paycheck to paycheck, who don't have care, child support, to have an infirmary at the school, possibly. I don't know, I'm just talking out of my head, but I have no idea. But something for the kids who have to go to school because the parents can't watch them and can't be off work, we need to have maybe another area for them. They can remotely into the classrooms. So there's a lot of changes, and I think it's going to have to happen because the respiratory illnesses don't go away. We just don't care that on an average year, 40 to 60,000 people die of the flu.
Right.
I think as of April 4th, it was 62,000, and now it's probably, estimated to be 80,000 of the flu. So, but because we are not overwhelming the healthcare system, but no one bats an eye, except for every flu season, we are overwhelmed. People are coming in droves. There's nothing that we can do with them. We tell them, go home, hydrate, take your Tylenol, wait it out. And then the sicker ones, we admit. And so there are percentages. It's the same thing that's happening with this. And so this is going to be the next common cold that causes people, though, who have comorbidities to succumb to that.
Right.
And so we need to take care of each other. So if you have a respiratory illness but you feel well, You wear a mask, you go out, the people know, oh, this person has one. Or if you wear a mask and you say, oh, they know that this person has low immunity. Oh, or this person is taking care of their 90-year-old person. Or this person has a child at home with cancer, and they need to be, they can't pick anything up. So we need to just be, you know, compassionate and empathetic that people are wearing masks.
Right. And we really need to re-educate ourselves for respiratory, to have respiratory manners, as you say.
Yeah. To have a respiratory etiquette. So right. You're going to make sure you sneeze into your arm. You're going to do it if you think that you have something, you know, you felt a little tired and weak and you thought maybe it is. Maybe you wear a mask, right. You know, and we don't shun people when they wear them. And for me, it's kind of like this, you know, if everybody's wearing a mask around me, I feel like, oh, I can take mine off because that's herd immunity. I'm safe, right? So if everybody else is wearing one, I don't have to wear it. So it's only if there's two of you and one of you is not feeling well, only one of you have to wear it, right? You don't have both, right? So you could do it either way. But I don't know which way we're going to do it. So you have to think of how what your situation is. But I think it just needs to be, we need to be more open about it and be more accepting of it, be more empathetic to people and understanding who are they taking care of, what's behind that mask, you know, what is going on.
That makes perfect sense. We are speaking to Dr. Anita Wong. And by the way, in preventative medicine, she's here in town in Laguna Beach. She also spent over 30 years as an ER doctor. I want to tap into that right now. As nursing homes seem to be suffering a substantial amount of the percentage of deaths. And I have the theory because we had spoken with some ambulance drivers and some EMT drivers about a couple of months back. In your experience in the ER, do ambulances and EMTs have enough time in between their calls to properly clean their ambulances and their rigs before they go to a nursing home?
Most likely not, but I think that they are doing the best that they can. I think there are disinfectants that you can use if they have the strong and disinfectants, and they can spray it down and wipe it down. They would have time to go because it's going to take you a few minutes. Now that I'm thinking about it, it takes more than 5 minutes to drive somewhere and you want to put the disinfectants on for a period of time. So depending on what agents that you're using, they can be, it can be because this is a weak, fairly weak virus. So it's envelope virus. So anything surfactant on it can actually really kill it quite quickly. So they, you know, I think that they are doing the best they can, and I'm sure that they are disinfecting as well as they can in between. The question is whether or not they are being able to protect themselves the best, because I think that we have to reuse PPEs because there was such a shortage on those.
Right.
So if they have to reuse those are not going to be as clean and could be contaminated. So that is there's a question there if they have to do that.
Okay. And there's been the question here in Orange County about the lack of testing. Should we be able to just walk into a CVS and just get a test without showing symptoms? And is that helpful? Would that be helpful in the future?
I think that testing, because we haven't had a uniform rollout. I mean, there's 120 different tests for antibodies. Not all of them are FDA approved. What is their quality? What is their, sensitivity, effectiveness of it? In New York, I think they have 10% of their negatives were false negatives. Okay. So there's false negatives, false positive. There's also another factor, which I forget. It begins with a P. Depends on that factor and on how well these tests are. So in the ideal world, we should be able to go in and get a test that has been vetted, that actually has been proven and accurate. And can give us accurate information. Right now, though, we are getting tests that if it's a negative, doesn't necessarily mean it's negative. So that is not really useful for us.
Right.
I just don't feel that I can feel as confident when somebody says they got a negative test, because it's not that the PCRs are exceptional. They find the active disease and find the genetics of the virus. But it's how adequate of the sample is, because it's very uncomfortable. Some of my patients say it's very painful. When you insert it nasal pharyngeal, then there's the saliva, and then there's others. And then some people have GI symptoms, so you should be testing the stools.
Right.
So we're not testing those. So, it just depends on your sampling. Was it adequate? And if it was adequate, and then sometimes people can't tolerate it. It's got to be there for 20 seconds, and 20 seconds is a long 20 seconds when you have something in you that's not very comfortable.
Right.
And sometimes I can't get it, leave it there for 20 seconds. So, when it comes back with negative, it's a grain of salt, because I'm never sure, was it an adequate sample or not an adequate sample? And was this with the test that was been validated? Because these tests are being individually validated. They're not being nationally validated. So my example is that if we had taken the ribbons, the pink ribbons for breast cancer, and we just tell everyone, wear pink ribbons. You're going to get some that are long, one with big bows and frilly bows, and ones with just one pink strand, and one with a long tail, and one with a short tail. There's going to be no uniformity, and not everybody's like, look at all these bows, but nobody knows what it's for.
Right.
But breast cancer, look at it. It's very concise. It's one little loop. They're short tails. They're not. You don't have one that's long, one that's short. You don't have one that's frayed. You don't have one's fringes. You don't have one with a little thing sticking out. You don't have one blah, blah, blah.
Right.
They're all the same. If we had one test that was consistent and uniform, and we knew what was the percentage of the false negatives, the false positives, and we knew that P factor and everything else, and then we could have a reliability. Right now, it's all over the place.
Right.
But ideally, I think yes, we should test everyone and should know, so we would have some data. We don't have clear data. We don't have clear data that we can use.
Aside from giving us great information and clear data, you have the greatest analogies, first with the Caltrans and now they're just fantastic analogies. I do want to talk briefly about the work you're doing here in town. We spoke a little bit about your work in strengthening the immune system and making sure that our immune systems are strong. I want to talk about some of the groundbreaking work that you've been doing in the field of incontinence. And a lot of us don't think about that, but you have been doing some groundbreaking work in the field of incontinence. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Well, I see people at their worst in the emergency room, and many people will come in and they're always there and no one speaks about it, and they don't really go to their doctors and talk about it. A really small percentage of women and men will even mention about this. This is just like a hidden embarrassment about this. They're leaking, or they're afraid that they smell or anything. And I see that in the ER a lot. And they say, oh, sorry, I didn't have my change of clothes, or I didn't get to change this pad and I'm leaking. And the worst thing that I'll see is prolapsed rectums and prolapsed uterus. I have to reduce those and put them back in when you have your pelvic muscles are so weak, they can't hold your internal organs up. People think about having strong biceps. They want to get their triceps looking strong. If you don't have strong triceps, you got these flabby little turkey wings underneath. But nobody's really thinking about the pelvic floor, right? So the pelvic floor muscles, they've got to be strengthened. We talk about the Kegels and doing those, but how often do you really do that? And, everybody thinks about it for a little bit. If you have a strong pelvic muscles, you're going to have enjoyment in your sex life, which everyone should continue having on even up in the up years. And when you have a strong pelvic floor, that you're going to be able to enjoy that part of your life, quality of life. And having a strong pelvic floor, there's either in conventional medicines, it's either by medications to reduce the urgency to go, or it was by surgery, by supporting those things that have fallen, by putting mesh in and lifting them up. But now there is this new, and I know there are people who are sensitive to electromagnetic frequencies, so this certainly would not be the technology for them. you know, I think it's safe because you're not having it constantly at you, but it's only because it's only a 3-week treatment, twice a week for 3 weeks with this device called Mcella, and it elevates you do 11,000 Kegels in 28 minutes. And what it essentially is just the muscle building in the pelvic floor, muscles that you don't contract and you utilize constantly. And it builds them up. And one of the side effects is, you know, better quality sex.
Okay.
You know, you have
a pretty good side effect.
Some side effects. So erectile dysfunction, it's a side effect that it actually improves that, too, because some of that is muscle contraction. Right. So. Urgencies and for stress incontinence, which is actually when you cough and sneeze, go running, you leak, when you have to get up in the middle of the night, you have to constantly get up. I have my patients, you know, they came in because they were saying, I get up every 2 hours. I can't get any sleep because I'm up every 2 hours. They send me in thank yous. I'm sleeping through the night. I went to bed at 10. I got up at 7. They said I slept through the night. They are so happy. You know, so this is people who are able to finish the round of golf now because they don't have to keep stopping, or they don't stop. They say, I can finish a movie. I can go out and see a movie. Not now, but before. these types of things.
Yeah, and those are things you don't think about, that, for instance, incontinence can ruin your sleep. It can actually, and then it affects the rest of your health by not getting enough sleep. It's just
exactly.
A never-ending circle. So you're involved in something called Face Masks for All here in Laguna. What exactly are you doing with them?
There is a project that's going on, Face Masks for All, and I've joined with other small businesses here locally to... get a face mask to every residents of Laguna Beach so that they would have a good quality, clean mask that they can use. And hopefully we can also avoid the stigma and change that stigma of it and just, you know, get everyone a mask that they can use.
Okay. Dr. Anita Wong, I can't tell you how grateful I am. I know you're busy and I appreciate your time. I know it's valuable. If you missed any portion of this, we're going to put it up on the KXFM webpage, on the podcast. You go to KXFM, look for podcasts and coronavirus. If they need to contact Dr. Wong, it's info@AnitaWongMD.com, but it's spelled W-A-N-G, Dr. Anita Wong. .com, and you can call me for the phone number, 734-0580. Dr. Wong, thank you so much for your time with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
We'll look forward to talking to you down the road. Thank you very much.
All right.